Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that.
Dr. Salah Salman with us, MD, and he's the author of Scrubbed Out, Reviving the Doctor's Role in Patient Care. He's worked as a physician and a professor and chairman of the Department of, I'm not even going to try to say it, Salah.
Otolaryngology.
That's the word I was looking for, the department of that in the American University of Beirut. He immigrated to the United States in 1986 and spent 23 years at Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary and Harvard Medical School. Again, he's the author of Scrubbed Out, Reviving the Doctor's Role in Patient Care. Salah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. By the way, you got a very, very clear reception. When I'm going to take you back, well, I can take me back 50, 60 years. And I remember when the doctor would come to your house, you'd have a problem. The doctor would have the little black bag and he would come to the house and he would fix things. That doesn't happen today. For some reason, it seems as though there's been a separation between the patient and the doctor. And there's got to be that bridge to get us back together again.
That's right. That's very true.
Now, where do you think that happened as far as the doctors and the patients, the relationship between the two? Where did we start to miss between the two?
I think when Medicare was introduced in the 60s, suddenly the people who were taking care of healthcare found that there's a big sum of money somewhere that needs to be tapped. And that's where corporations got into the picture. And they took over and gradually transformed healthcare from a mission or a service into a business.
Okay, so go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
And it is the one of my theses in the book is that the medical profession has accepted to be displaced by these business-oriented executives in hospitals and, of course, in the insurance company. And gradually, the profession transformed itself and became a business. And the majority of doctors who are well-trained and who mean well and who do want to serve the public have become a minority. And with a political correctness atmosphere in big hospitals and in academia, where unfortunately some sort of dictatorship is prevailing, nobody speaks. And we found ourselves as doctors taking orders from executives and hospital administrators. I think this is where the problem started. When I started working as a medical doctor 50 years ago, things were a little different. Now, the picture has changed, like you so well drew, and it seems to be getting worse. And the facts about healthcare in the U.S. are alarming, but still, nobody seems to see, to read the writing on the wall. Somebody called this mural dyslexia. The danger signals are there, but nobody seems to be do anything about it. The cost still goes up, and we end up with a country and 15% of the population has no health insurance. A scandal, in my opinion, in the U.S. today.
Absolutely. I think there's a couple of components that we have to look at. Number one, obviously, you said it's the money, the major corporations. There's also a political component to use healthcare as some kind of a weapon against the opponents or as a tool to allow them also to get votes. competition between insurance companies doesn't even exist. You take Florida, for instance. The cost of insurance in Florida is almost it's astronomical compared to some of the other states. Now, all of the insurance companies are not licensed to do business in Florida, so therefore you've got a monopoly there with a couple of insurance companies, and they don't have to worry about competition. They don't have to lower their prices. The other component to take a look at is the attorneys. When we look at the attorneys, everybody is so happy today. There are doctors today that if you walk into the office, they have to complete tests that normally they wouldn't have to do, just to do some defensive medicine so they don't get sued. Reversible cause and effect. We, the patients, cause the doctors to be extra careful. They have to raise their prices because their malpractice goes up. I mean, this goes on and on and on. Somewhere we lost total control over it.
This argument is certainly valid, but is used often. But I don't think it is the correct argument. We are under pressure to order tests because there is a new machine that we bought for millions, and we have to pay for it. The scare of the malpractice is there, but actually, it is extremely rare. You may have read the book says there are 98,000 deaths per year in America from medical mistakes, and there aren't 98,000 lawsuits. And the study that I quote in the book says a small percentage of the medical mistakes, malpractice, and in a lawsuit, and in these lawsuits, a small percentage of them win anyway. So this really is not a good enough excuse. I'm a doctor, and I know when a patient comes to me and he says, I have a headache, do I have a brain tumor? I try to tell him or her, no, you don't. Let's wait a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and then we'll see if other symptoms develop. I do not think we need to do an MRI or a CAT scan because the patient says, do I have a brain tumor? But the system encourages this. The hospital is happy because we order these tests. But patients really make sense and are willing to listen to a doctor once they go back to trusting the doctor. And that's where there is a problem here. Patients don't trust us anymore because they think we're businessmen making money. And I guess most of us are not, but some of us certainly are. And
no
I
question.
Think the bad lemons have really spoiled the reputation of the medical profession.
So let me tell you what I'm hearing you say. There's an old adage that if you ask the wrong questions, you get the right answers to the wrong questions, you never get anywhere. You ask the right questions, you get the right answers, and it puts you on track. From what I'm hearing you say, that the population at large is asking the wrong questions, and we're not getting the answers that we need to help fix the problem.
That's correct. I've witnessed scenarios. Instead of the doctor spending 5 extra minutes explaining why there is no reason yet to panic, writing a request for a study saves time and everybody's happy. But that's not how medicine should be practiced.
But is it medicine anymore? Is it medicine anymore? What would you even call it? You know, we've got the Obamacare coming in. My goodness, who even knows what that is and what it covers up? Is it even medicine anymore? Have we gotten so far out of the off track that what we used to call medicine is not medicine anymore? And go ahead.
Yes, I agree with you fully. But then what alarms me is that we all know that, but nobody seems to be do anything about it. And the decision makers, those in the healthcare driver's seat who are trying to find solutions, are really the cause of the problem. And that's where I'm a little upset with my profession, because we have accepted to be sidelined and we enjoy making money. Doctors make a lot of money. And of course we have expenses. Of course we spend years of training. All this is this is true, but does that justify a doctor to spend only 2 or 3 minutes per patient, or answer a telephone call suggesting that I don't have time to talk to you, I'm very busy, or the nurse does the answering? No. I think unfortunately, the minority of us who mean well have learned to keep quiet with the excuse of political correctness. We all take an oath on graduation called the Hippocratic Oath. And this is the oath that is being scrubbed out systematically and regularly. And I don't see anybody reacting. And that's why I panicked. And that's why I suggested major changes, even if this involves a revolution. We cannot stay going like this. We are going bankrupt. We all know that. And who's doing anything? I don't think anybody's doing anything. Corporations are the bosses. They lobby the Congress, and the Congress does what corporations want. Both the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies are making huge profits when 15% of the population has no health insurance. I can't see that. When all other industrialized countries have universal health insurance, a human right, after all, come on.
Sure. No, by the way, I'm on your side with that. There's a term that you used when you said the healthcare driver's seat. I think one of the biggest problems that we have today is very simple, very basic, and you just said it. I'll paraphrase it in a different way. The people that are in the driver's seat are not doctors. The people that are in the driver's seat are either attorneys or politicians or someone, business people, that have nothing to do with the industry in and of itself, but they're looking at what the industry will garner for them, which happens to be capital. If you want a healthcare industry, you let doctors run the industry. You want politicians, you want politics, you don't put attorneys in there, you put statespeople in there, statesmen in there. So I think that one of the biggest problems we have, that the people who are in the industry on a day-to-day basis that are actually practically putting their hands on it and working with it, aren't the ones in control. And you, as the doctors, you should be in control of this, but it got taken away from you. I didn't say you let it go. It got taken away.
That's what I say in the book, but with a proviso, that the profession has to reform itself, to police itself. Unless we do that, I don't think then we should be allowed the privilege and the honor of fixing healthcare.
Absolutely.
Is this clear?
Yeah, very. Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. The proviso basically is that if you're going to do it, also be responsible for the consequence and the outcome of doing it. But I truly believe that if you're going to fix anything, you have to have the people that are practically working on, hands-on, on a day-to-day basis. They're the ones who see truly what goes on. It's not academia. It's the wisdom that comes after the information when you're out there and you're, quote-unquote, you're the foot soldier, you're the troops on the ground, and you're doing it online. Yeah, I agree.
That's absolutely correct. That's what I think needs to be done. Is this going to happen? It depends on us, really, because all what's happening has not produced tangible results yet. We do not have universal health care. The cost is increasing at an alarming rate, and I don't see who's doing what about it. Nothing. Except talking, rhetoric, and discussions.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we could bring down the cost, one of the ways we can bring down the cost, is make it more competitive. Get the insurance companies in there, get the doctors in there, and allow them to compete against each other. And basically, it's that branding, the value proposition. Why should you come to me, Dr. Dresser, as opposed to going to Dr. So-and-so down the street? I really believe that you have to get creative with this. You have to make it individualized. And also, I saw something interesting today. I went to breakfast with my brother, and we walked into a small restaurant down the street. And as we walked in, the waitresses were talking to the customers coming in. They were calling them by their first name. They were patting them on the shoulder. They were saying, "Where have you been?" It was that connection that somehow we have lost in this culture that we live in today. And that has to come back. That also has to come back within the medical industry.
I hope so. My father was a doctor, and that's how he was treating patients. But it's different now. We have accepted, we as doctors have accepted the fact that because of our greed, we can justify cutting down the standards of healthcare by seeing more patients than normally we should be able to see. And we're getting away with it because the administrators are happy. We're generating more money.
Okay, but there's a step. We're starting to run out of time, but there's a step beyond that too. With the way healthcare is going today, doctors aren't going to be able to afford to be able to handle a lot of the patients who aren't covered by Medicare, by some of the different insurance companies that that Medicare works for. So I really believe that it's a situation whereby everybody's got to get involved in this. It can't just be the doctors. It has to be the doctors. It has to be the patients. It has to be local and federal politics. It's got to be everybody looking at this, getting together and moving forward with it.
No question about it. Except that I think the medical profession has to lead this revolution or this change.
Yeah.
It is the only one ready and trained to lead.
No question about it. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you, buy the book, get more information?
Yes. The website is www.scrubbedoutdoctors.com.
Wonderful. By the way, if it went by too fast, it'll be up on our website so people can go there and find it. Sal, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think the issue that you're addressing is critically important, and it's not just an issue of, let's do right by it. We're talking about life and death here. And that's something that we better take a good look at, or there are a lot of people who are quote unquote going to die out there that didn't have to.
Thank you. I think you got the gist of the problem. And I'd like to see some movement. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. And thank you so much for being with us.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Vienna, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Jack Abramoff with us. He is the author of Capital Punishment, The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption, from America's Most Notorious Lobbyist. You got to start early in politics. Magna cum laude graduate of Brandeis University, Georgetown University Law Center. He was national chairman of the College of Republicans, the leader of the President Reagan's grassroots lobbying organization. He joined K Street in 1994, signing in with the lobbying division of Preston Gates, where he built one of the nation's most prestigious and profitable lobbying practices. When a corporation, Indian tribe, or foreign nation needed to win, they went to Team Abramoff. Let us say, Jack, I welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Jack, what went wrong? You built it. It was there. What didn't you see that caused you to get off track?
Well, I think what happened was over time, as I competed in the lobbying industry and did everything I could to get victories for my clients and, you know, get wins on our belt notch, unfortunately, I stopped seeing the where the lines in the sand were drawn, and I started getting all wrapped up in these efforts and winning at all costs and that kind of thing. And it's not a news tale, you know, a tale of hubris and unfortunately arrogance that led to my being my downfall.
Now, by the way, when we talk about arrogance, is that something that's inherent in the business as a lobbyist being tied in with the politicians? Because over all of the years that I've been a broadcaster, I remember people running for office. You know, would talk to them, and interview them. And then as the years would go by, if they got into the office, I'd do another interview, and they weren't the same people. It seems as though there's like, Jack, there's a euphoria. It's almost like a drug that happens, and who you were kind of disappears within all of this.
I think that's exactly right. It is a drug, and one gets full of oneself in Washington, D.C. Pretty easy. There's a lot of power there, and people have a lot of ability, and, you know, running around town with your chest out, and I'm the biggest fighter in town, and that kind of thing is a normal posture. And unfortunately, it leads some people down paths that they shouldn't go. And in general, it's not good for the country, because this isn't what our founders had intended when this republic was set up.
Now, when we talk about this, and, you know, we take a look at all of the people that we see in office now, people, Barney Frank, who's been there for, what, 30 years now, they come in, they get involved in it, and then politics becomes something completely different than the average person realizes. And then before you know it, we forget who's working for who, and it happens in so many cases. If you were to have it to do over again, what was the major lesson? What was the one thing that if you'd have just kind of fell down in the middle of it and got up and said, I need to see this, what would that have been?
Well, I think there are a couple things. First, on the just sort of micro level, follow the rules. You know, don't think that the rules don't apply to you. And that is a big disease in town, and it's certainly one I caught. And now, you know, my life is very different, obviously, and I follow all the rules. In fact, I follow the rules so much that my kids can't stand driving with me because I, you know, follow the speed limits.
Yeah.
But the problem is nobody's following the speed limit in Washington. They're just not caring about it. And the thing is, the government has grown, the federal government has grown over the years to the point where they have power and control over everything in this country, and that's really not what was intended. But that kind of power invested in people's hands tends to corrupt them. And unfortunately, that's even if it's just a corruption of arrogance, it's far worse in many cases, of course, as you know. It's a problem.
Now, when was it that you realized that you went farther than you should go and they could be standing at your door any moment?
Well, unfortunately for me, I didn't realize it until I was already done. That's one of the biggest regrets I have, that I didn't sit back and say, well, what am I doing here? What am I involved in? And is this really what was intended? I mean, part of the problem for me was that I had all these clients. I was winning victories for them. I supported their causes. I liked them. You know, I wanted to get them success, and we did. And, you know, they paid me upwards of about $80 million, me and the people who worked for me, about $80 million over the course of time I was a lobbyist. And we delivered, we added up about $6 billion worth of, you know, benefit to them. So we thought everything was great there. And then my wife and I, you know, we lived comfortably. We didn't live extravagantly. We never even paid off our mortgage, actually. But we wound up giving away most of the money we made, about 80% of it, to charity. So I wound up thinking, gosh, I'm doing great. You know, I'm doing good. You know, I'm giving to charity. I'm helping people win good fights. And I wasn't paying attention to the fact that I'm doing all these things in an atmosphere I shouldn't have even been in.
You know what I would do if I would if I was king of America and I had the proverbial magic wand and I could kind of step by a few things. If I was going to become quote unquote president of the United States, I would love to have a guy like you in as either vice president, attorney general, or, you know, in a position, because you've got to get that hands on the street, knowing what goes on, what could happen, what the consequences are. And that experience that you have is absolutely golden as far as a political venue would be.
Well, it definitely is. And what I'm trying to do is use it for the good at this point. Obviously, I was using my political smarts, as they were, to advance the client causes and to, you know, make a lot of money and do a lot of what I thought were good things. But at this point in my life, obviously having been wiped out and not being in that world again, I sort of came to the conclusion that the knowledge I do have, which is probably somewhat unique in terms of not too many people saw what I saw, those who did are frankly still doing it, and but I could be in a position to where I could do some good and maybe make some recompense for what I was.
Now, by the way, you take a good look at what's going on today, Republican, Democrat, doesn't really matter. Where do you see, and now from your experience of everything that you did, and obviously your political bent, where do you see the country going today?
Well, we're really heading over a cliff, unfortunately. You know, we've had since the 30s this prolific spending, which is driven, by the way, in large part by the special interests. And I think people aren't really aware of how much they have to play in this, and I try to discuss somewhat of it in my book. But we're heading over a cliff. We're heading into an economic area that we don't know. We can see what's going to happen by what's going on in Europe, but they don't have the political will to solve these problems in Washington. They're so stuck in their ways and so stuck with what they think the federal government should look like that they want to make a little tinkerings, and I think we're heading into a real problem, unfortunately.
Okay, based on your experience, do you see anybody on the horizon that has the wherewithal and the strength to stand up and to take on what we have to beat? And there are a lot of things we have to beat. I'm not talking about not a political opponent, but our culture. Our culture is dying. I have watched this. I have been around for many, many years now. I was a kid in the 50s, junior high school, et cetera, all the way through the 50s. So I've seen tremendous changes that we've had in this country. Do you think it's too late to come back?
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, if anything, just based on my experience that I've been around a little while in D.C. since pretty much the 70s in politics, I think things are better in a certain respect that the people have risen up already. The people rose up in the last election in 2010. There are different movements and different grumblings and rumblings out there. And I think that the more that that continues, the more that people realize that they have power. America is set up in a way that the American people can put their foot down and kick these guys out and put in the kind of people who are going to change things. The question is, will they do it? Will they pay attention more to this than they do to American Idol? Will they pay attention more to what their future for their children is going to be than they do to Jersey Shore? Those are the questions that America's got to ask itself.
Now, let's take it to another bent. I spent 2 days in prison, I think, what was it, 25, 30 years ago, wherever it was. I was in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I was in broadcasting. There was a cab company in the same building. The owner of the cab company had been murdered, and one couple of the cab drivers did it. They caught him with blood all over him at the airport. And these were the guys who used to come up and get advertising at the in the station. And I got a phone call one day. It was from the guy who was accused of murder, and he said, something's wrong. He said, Michael, he said, there was a psychic you had on the show, and I don't think I should be here, and yada, yada. When it was over, I picked up the phone and called the chief of police, and I said, what's going on here? Why is it that he can call me? One thing led to the other. We got a hold of the mayor. We got a hold of the warden of the prison there, the state prison, And I said, I want to go to jail for a couple of days. So they did. They arrested me, and I went through the process for 2 days. Let me tell you what I saw in 2 days. And by the way, it would never be the experience that you had. The 2 days that I saw was this. The guys had, you know, they had good food. They had television. They had a lot of different things. But the key was this. That when I say they had it so easy, that the recidivism rate was tremendous there. Because the guys would, right around winter time, they'd go out and cause a problem, so they go to jail for 4 or 5 months and get taken care of. They got to a point where when they got out into the population, the civilian population, they couldn't deal with what was out there. Did you find anything like that in your time in jail?
Well, you know, it's interesting what you speak about. I was in a federal prison, so they didn't allow people to kind of, you know, you can't do something and hang out in the jail to keep warm. Usually when they put you in, you're staying for a while. And there was nobody I met in prison who wanted to be there, at least not in terms of their words. The recidivism problem, in part, has to do with the fact that these guys go to prison. A lot of them, you know, 80-90% of the people in my prison were drug dealers. And these guys spend their life in prison, and it's nothing to them, I guess, and they don't really wind up getting any kind of education. They don't go through the educational system when they're outside. When they're inside, there really is nothing to teach them. Prison is a storage facility for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they used to have programs where they take them and treat them like they're in the Army and things like that, and, you know, there's a lot of, frankly, wisdom to that, trying to give people discipline. Instead, what you find and what I found in my prison was that guys would sleep all day, guys would play cards all night, and, you know, not enough of us were getting up for work. I treated everything very seriously in prison. Obviously, I tried to follow every rule, you know, the focus on me was a little intense because of my high, you know, visibility. Yeah. But the American prison system needs to have a restructuring. Because what's happening is, as you've noticed, there's a recidivism rate. People are coming in and out of the prison. Their kids, they come out of prison, they have a lot of kids, and those kids are going right into prison too. And it's getting out of control. So we need culturally to rework this. But that's a bigger, you know, that's a bigger issue than I can take on myself. I'm just trying to do the thing I'm sort of an expert in. Obviously, I became a bit of an expert in terms of prison, but sure, Everybody does in there.
But see, part and parcel, I think, Jack, the big word here is culture. The culture has changed dramatically. Now, I happen to be Jewish, and when I went to school, we sang, you know, we sang Christmas carols, we had Christmas trees, we exchanged presents, we did all the things. That was the American culture. It had nothing to do with my religion. And when I see what's going on today, you know, get Christianity out of the schools and do this and that, whatever. What it is, it's an attack on the culture. They attack them, they attack me, and so on and so forth. So as the culture transitions here to whatever, wherever it's going, unless we stand up, I think the prison system in and of itself is nothing more than a mirror of what's going on in the culture outside. Because if you really take a look at it, the entitlement, and, you know, you take care of me, you pay for me, you do this, I don't have to do anything, it's easy here if I know how to handle it. So realistically, whether it's business, whether it's politics, whether it's prison, it's all an attack on the culture, and the transition is happening very rapidly, and if we don't do something about it, we're going to be in major trouble within the next 5-10 years.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, unfortunately, our Western civilization, which is the greatest civilization in history in terms of achievement, in terms of goodness and great things that have happened thanks to Western civilization, and I'm Jewish also, and frankly, thanks to Christendom and their abilities to do great things, everybody's ashamed of that now. Everybody talks disparagingly about that. We have to act as if we're ashamed of being Americans. We have to constantly be on guard that people wouldn't be angry at us because we're trying to promote our nation. Even seen with Hollywood now, if you notice, the films they make now have to be stripped of all pro-American vestiges because we're afraid that foreigners might not like us. That all contributes to the decline of our culture and our civilization.
Well, my concern is this, and we're starting to run out of time. My concern is that you don't get your word out as much as you can, as strong as you can, because realistically, when we take a look at things, when we Rocky said it in the last movie, Sylvester Stallone, and I really believe it, and that's what we have to think about today. It's not how hard you hit. It's how hard you can get hit, get up, and keep moving forward. And that's a message that we all need very much today. And out of what happened to you, in the end result, it was probably the best gift you could ever have, because look what it's done for you, and look at the direction that you're taking, and look at the lives you can change if you get into the right spot at the right time and speak to the right people.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, yeah, no, I got it. Hey, and by the way, now, do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. I have Abramoff.com, where my book is available. Of course, it's available on Amazon and the rest, too. But through Abramoff.com, people have been communicating with me and writing to me and conversing with me about these things. And hopefully the discussion and the conversation can continue to the point where we can get something done.
Wonderful. Hey, Jack, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It's a big honor to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
When I'm gone away, you're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so fit. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you some of these days,
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Clint Evans with us. He's the author of Finding Your Fit, Unlocking the Mystery to Your Golden Dream Job or Your Business. Former hiring manager Clint the Money Man Evans is the founder of More Customers Online. He conducts workshops for the Small Business Administration and advises companies on how to grow their online business. Clint, hi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hey, Michael, glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I think in today's world, especially when you're dealing with online businesses, more and more people, because of the outsourcing, because of the businesses closing down, they've gone home, they've gone on their kitchen table, they got their computer, and they've been in business, and it's competitive out there. And I really believe today, more and more people have to know how to do it. Just because you have an idea doesn't mean that you can be successful at it.
Absolutely. You can look out, littered across the landscape, various inventors and people with great ideas. I mean, you got to have that. That's kind of the foundation, but that's only about 10% of it. Promotion, consistent promotion, that's the other 90% that actually makes it a success.
No, absolutely. What was it that caused you to get into this? What did you see in this world of online businesses that sparked you?
Okay, Michael. Yeah, that gets into a little of my background. My story has lots of twists and turns. I've been a part of 8 failed businesses, 2 traditional jobs, and a few more temporary jobs, and run a pretty good spectrum, so I've learned what not to do and what does work. And so after seeing thousands of resumes, doing hundreds of interviews and hirings, both for my own businesses and clients, I know what successful applicants did to get my attention. And also in the business arena, like you had mentioned, I've helped one of my clients. He had a business that had tanked after the financial crisis. He had been doing about $70,000 a month. 2008 crisis hit. He was down to $35,000 a month, concerned that his business was going under. And I, after working with him for a little over a year now, he's back up to between $65,000 and $70,000 per month, even in this terrible economy. So it's taught me a lot of things, and really I found where I fit best, because I'm fascinated by the psychology and the marketing. It's just where my passion is, and so that's how I got into this.
Now, let's look at finding your fit, or, you know, that dream job, quote unquote. Most people do not know how to do an interview. I mean, given what I've seen over the years, and given what's going on today, people just walk into an interview with no thought of what they want to accomplish at the end of the day. What does it take? What is that magic that will cause somebody to look at me, to listen to what I have to say, and then potentially hire me?
Okay, Michael, that's an excellent question, and it's kind of interesting because the people I'm talking to say that they're really great on the phone and they're fantastic in person. The hurdle they're coming up against is just actually getting past out of the digital trash heap and getting the hiring manager's attention. So we could talk about that a little later in the interview. In terms of the listener actually doing well in their interview, a lot of it has to do with beginning with the end in mind. Like you said, they've got to know what they're looking to accomplish. What is the most powerful one or two main points that they can get that interviewer to understand about them that really focuses that interviewer in on, hey, this guy would be, or this lady would be a great hire. She would really help the company along in whatever position, really further the company's goals there. And also, of course, make the hiring manager look good, because that's a big concern on hiring people's minds, is if they make a mistake with all of the taxes and benefits and all the other things it takes to hire an employee, making a mistake and then going through any kind of unemployment and all that is very costly. So one of the things about going into that interview is keeping that in mind, that the hiring person's perspective in mind, they're terrified for their jobs too. Very few jobs are safe and secure anymore, so they're terrified of making a mistake, and they're certainly looking to further their own career and get promoted. So if you can show them that by hiring you, it's going to be a fantastic fit for the company, that will, of course, make them look good. In terms of the one or two bullet points, the person can really highlight how one or two of their past experiences would really fit in and help further the company's goals in the current position they're interviewing for.
I think one of the things that we have to look at, and there's a word that scares most people if they've never been involved or anywhere near marketing, is the word selling. Most people are frightened to death of that word. And when you're in an interview, you got to sell yourself. You know, when it comes down to it, bottom line, you have to sell yourself. And you don't have to be overt with it. You could be very subtle. But that's really the key. Selling, the definition of selling is offer and acceptance. That's it, period, end. You find somebody, you fall in love, you look at her and you say, will you marry me? Well, you've given her an offer. She's going to accept or reject you. If she accepts you, you've sold it. And that's what we really have to do. You've got to believe in yourself enough, plus have the structure to do it. It's a sell. Any way you look at it, you've got to sell yourself.
You're absolutely right, Michael. And one of the chapters in my book is titled Why You're in Sales, Even If You Don't Think So, because you mentioned a couple of things from personal life. In the dating world, there's a lot of systems out there that break it down and compare it to business, and that you're prospecting. You're probably going to have to approach various numbers of women, and some of them you'll hit it off with, and you'll sense that connection is there, and the sale progresses, so to speak, and maybe you get into a relationship and go from there. Business is the same thing. When you're talking with that interviewer on the phone or meeting with someone in person, your confidence, how you're able to communicate, whether you're eloquent or fumbling on your words, and you can fumble on your words a little bit What's far more important is your industry knowledge and how you can put that into the perspective of the company and making the hiring person look good. If you can convey that in your communications and your messaging, even if you fumble on your words a little bit, if you've got a lot of the insider knowledge and they can see that you'd be a good fit for the position, that's really what you're talking about in terms of sales. And I think people get an image in their mind of like a sleazy 70s used car salesman with the crazy polyester suit, and it's certainly not that anymore.
And don't forget the bell bottoms, the 70s.
Oh, yeah, there you go, for sure. Slick back, greasy hair, and the old, I won't say it on the radio, but you know what kind of mustache.
Yeah, them. Okay. But when it really comes down to it, there's another component, there's another element here. And that element is this. You may go in to apply for a job, and they may have something open that you didn't think of. They weren't even thinking of you because they didn't know you till you walked in, that could be the absolute perfect fit. So it's also keep it open, because you may end up with something better than you came in for in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we get back to the whole begin with the end in mind, have a couple of goals of really what you're looking to convey when you communicate in that interview and when you give your interview, because depending on how you position what you say, like you mentioned, Michael, the interviewer might say, well, that doesn't exactly fit with this position, but if you can increase our sales by 17%, we could create this new opportunity for you over here in your own department. So certainly that can open up other opportunities depending on how you position what you say in your interview.
Sure. And Clint, one of the reasons I truly believe that finding your fit is timely today, because 20, 30, 40 years ago, you went to apply for a job, maybe you had three or four people you were up against, the decision was made, and somebody did or didn't get a job. You go for a job today in this economy, you got 10,000 people because of the internet and everything else applying for the same job. So you've got to be able to stand out. There's got to be that certain something that they recognize in you that they didn't see in the other people.
Absolutely, Michael. And even before the recession hit, I was getting 1,157, 683 applications. And so I talk to people like this when I'm consulting or working with somebody. I'll say, if you go into a clown convention with 1,157 other clowns, are you going to want to dress up like a clown? If you're in the middle of that mass, are you going to get noticed? Probably not. But if you go in there with a nice business suit and tie on, or if you're a lady, you've got your business clothing on, and you're the only one in that whole group of clowns, you're going to stand out, and they're going to notice you. And in terms of actually getting the phone call and getting to that interview point, I was seeing a ton of just the same type of subject lines, you know, application for assistant position or applying for assistant position, applying for office position. And I make it a point, like I give an example of a nursing position. Basically, you could say, yeah, you're applying for a nursing position. You could say that, or you could say nursing job. Christmas time patient volume soars 37%. Here's my solutions. I mean,
absolutely.
Which one do you think out of 1,000 of those, which one is going to stand out?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, and stop me if I'm wrong, because I'm not a hiring expert. But I would venture to guess that behind the eyes, in the mind of that person that's going to do the interview, that works for the company, the one thing and the one thing only they're looking for is who is going to be able to help me increase my bottom line? Who is going to help me increase what comes into this place? And in the end result, I think that's what they're looking for.
Absolutely. Even if it's an office administrative position job or an accounting job, if you can go through those numbers or help the company save money, if they look at you as an expense, that is a bad position to be in. So even if you're in a position that's traditionally considered an expense, if you can figure out ways to where the sales process is bogging down, or if you've got customers calling in complaining about one particular aspect of the company's sales campaign or sales process, and you can help them massage that wrinkle out of there and smooth things out and end up making more money and converting more sales, then you've certainly positioned yourself better for promotions and for keeping your job, because that's a big concern as well. If if you are employed, that that could go away if they see you only as an expense.
Well, that's an important word, positioning. I think that's realistically what it is. And because somebody wants to apply for a job, that doesn't mean they know how to do it. Like what you said up front, you know, you had a couple of failed businesses, you got knocked down, you got back up again, you got knocked down, you got up again. That's who you learn from. You don't learn from somebody who's always done it right, because that doing it right may not be the right doing it for you. So it's learning what not to do and then paying it forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard the tail end of the other guy's interview, and he said something about the movie Rocky, where today it's not so much about staying up and being a champion all the time, but it's getting knocked down and how many times you get back up until you finally push through whatever the universe is demanding and get to the other side, which is success.
Sure, and no question about it. And realistically, there are a tremendous amount of people out there today. They just, Clint, they don't know how to do it. And I think that's where it's critical. We all in certain areas need to be held by the hand. If I sat behind your desk, if I walked in tomorrow, sat right behind your desk and you said, okay, go ahead and do it, I'm going to get lost. You know, I've got to have some experience. I've got to be guided. You got to symbolically, don't send me flowers. You got to hold my hand for a while and bring me through it. And that's realistically what it's about. If you have somebody who can bring you through it, then it eliminates all of the quote unquote pain that you have to go through to get where you want to be.
For sure, Michael. Whenever you can follow a proven blueprint, and there's certainly a lot of questions going on. I got a question on my website earlier today about writing a good targeted cover letter and resume. One of the most basic things that I don't even think a whole lot about, because I figured people learn that in school, but obviously there's a big need out there to really learn about what gives that wow factor to actually cause the hiring manager to pick up the phone and call you as one of the 5 or 10 candidates they're actually going to consider versus the other 8 or 10,000 that are just going to go into the digital trash can and never even be looked at.
Oh, no question about it. And that is learned. I think everything in life is a learned response, a learned behavior, and then you get a response for whatever it is that you learned. But it is. It's a process. It's a strategy. It's a step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And when people start to get it, the people who are going to hire you recognize you took the time. I'm going to go back to the example you gave of somebody really making sure that they dressed the part going in as opposed to everybody else. If I'm going to hire somebody, I'm going to take a look at that also, because if that man or woman is going to take that extra step to be looking good, to be thinking ahead, to be thinking about what I'm thinking about, you bet. I'm going to look at them first.
Absolutely. Put yourself in the hiring manager's shoes. And a lot of people know their industry, so you know what's appropriate. If you're an investment banker, you know full suit and tie is required business wear. If you're in the music industry, man, you can probably go in with a nose ring and crazy purple hair and maybe those beat up tattered jeans that you buy at the store with holes in them. I don't know exactly what the term for that is, but they're not used, but something, there's some special term where you buy them and they've got the holes in them. So know your industry, know what kind of clothing is appropriate, and again, put yourself in that hiring manager's shoes. The more you can be like them and the more forethought you can put into the way you look before you even speak a word, the much further along in the game you are before he even says hello or starts in with the first question, you're already well above the crowd, and he's liking you as one of the top 2 or 3 candidates to get a second interview or even get an offer.
I hear you. Clint, we're running out of time. Website we can find you at?
It is feelcapableofmore.com, because basically finding your fit, there's a lot of people I've found out there that you feel capable of more, and you're looking for a step-by-step proven blueprint to better communicate and position yourself, and that's what Feel Capable of More is all about. I've got a free report they can get on there, which is going to go into some 3 insider tactics they can use to get the hiring person's attention so they can actually get the phone call. And there's a whole bunch more in that free report. So they can go to Feel Capable of More, grab that, get a copy of my book, which is going to teach a whole lot more about communication and positioning.
Wonderful. Hey, Clint Evans, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Michael. I was glad to be here, and you have a great evening.
You too. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love I can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'd be glad to know that my plans are small. I'll say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. And that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. It works much better when you have the microphone turned on. Dr. Robert Hurley with us. Bob Hurley is the author of The Decision to Trust, How Leaders Create High Trust Organizations. He's an award-winning professor at Fordham University, president of Hurley Associates. He's been a core faculty member in Columbia Business School's Leading and Managing People program for the last 15 years now. He's consulted for such organizations as NASA, Avon Products, IBM, Mercedes-Benz, State Farm Insurance, Kraft Foods, Kinko's, and he's written for publications including the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, and many, many more. Bob, hi, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Bob, when we look at the word trust, in the last 10, 15 years, is this something that we find to be lacking, causing some of the problems that we have today? Is that word that is so important, it's such a commonality that has to be there for anybody to succeed, is that word getting diluted today?
I wouldn't say necessarily the word's getting diluted. Trust is declining, though. So just to be clear, when I say trust, I define trust as a feeling of confident reliance in another person, group, or an institution. And what is being diluted is actually the degree to which people trust business, government, the media. Those institutions, trust in those institutions has been declining for about 30 years now. So it's problematic.
Okay, so realistically, when we're talking about the word trust, it covers everything, a whole wide range of everything that we deal with, from politics to business to education to the relationships in and of themselves. So the core message that we're talking about here, we're talking business, but it really relates to everything, doesn't it?
No question about it. You know, trust is about relationship, right? So you can have a relationship between a husband and wife, and we can characterize that relationship as one of trust or suspicion. Same thing with your employer. You can have a relationship with your employer of trust or suspicion. Your peer in your company, you can have a relationship of trust or suspicion. So, and by the way, when we make a judgment to be suspicious, it creates all sorts of problems, whether it be in a relationship, in a household, in a company, or in a nation. Cooperation breaks down. Progress is more difficult when there's a lack of trust.
Okay, so really, when it comes down to it, and right from your press release, which I think, Bob, is so critically important, grounded in research and decision making, and over 20 years of work with over 3,000 managers in North America, Europe, Asia, it's the base that our decisions are made from about trust. There are 10 factors that you talk about. And in those 10 factors, have you found those factors were the overarching theme that caused the organizations, people, relationships to trust each other and be able to move forward?
Absolutely. You know, one of the problems with trust is that we sometimes don't understand trust well, so we make mistakes. We trust people who aren't trustworthy. So part of what I tried to do in this book is to be very clear about what trustworthiness is. And just to explain, people generally give trust to those they feel are trustworthy, right? So in the trust judgment and the decision to trust, what people essentially do is they try and judge trustworthiness. And so I've identified 10 factors that affect that whole decision-making process, including, interestingly, and not a lot of people have talked about this, 3 factors that have to do with the person deciding to trust or be suspicious. We sometimes think that trust is all about the other person, but it's true that some of us have a hard time trusting no matter who the other person is. Right, so we all we vary in our capacity to trust. Some people don't trust anyone. Some people trust blindly. So I talk about 3 factors there, and then I talk about 7 factors that really have to do more with the relationship and the situation that will determine whether somebody is seen as trustworthy or not, or quite frankly, whether your organization is seen as trustworthy or not. Factors like similarities, capability, and I can talk some more about some of them.
Yeah, Bob, let me hold you up just for a minute. But doesn't that start with who's running it? Isn't that the trickle-down effect? If I don't trust me, then how am I going to trust you? How am I going to trust people that I'm dealing with? And when I say I don't trust me, that doesn't mean I'm going to rob myself from my bank account. But what if I know about myself that I'm going to get it to a certain level and I'm going to get really uncomfortable and I'm not really going to be that solid person that you met at 2 or 3 levels below, and I may not trust myself to be able to go on and deal with it? I think that in and of itself has a lot to do with the relationship that we deal with. If you're dealing with somebody who doesn't trust themselves, they're not going to trust anybody around them.
That's absolutely right. One of the ways actually to discern whether someone has issues around trust or difficulty in trusting is count the number of times they use the word loyalty and trust in a conversation. Mm. People who have issues with trust often don't trust other people, and those people tend not to trust them. So Morton Deutsch, who I studied with at Columbia, had an interesting way to look at this. He said, when you start a relationship with trust, when you are trusting, it induces other people to trust you.
Yeah. No, I completely believe that. When you really come down to it, it all starts with the people that you're dealing with in the first place, and it also starts with yourself. There's the old adage, rather be unhappy than unsure. And there's risk-taking when you're dealing with trust also. And risk-taking is one of the basic concepts of what caused us to be who we are as a nation, as an industrial nation, as capitalists, and so on and so forth. It was called You risk, and from the risk there's a reward, and from the reward there's more incentive. So there's got to be that formula involved in what you do if you're dealing with businesses.
But, you know, it's interesting, Michael. You're right. The United States as a country grew and prospered because we took risks. But it's also true that this country prospered because we trusted each other. We had a common bond. And you look at, you know, whether it's World War I or, you know, the Revolutionary War or World War II, these are, you know, there were generations of Americans that came together, trusted each other, cooperated with each other to overcome tremendous challenges. We're not seeing that happening quite the same way today.
No.
Whether you want to look at the failure of the Super Committee or the partisan gridlock or Occupy Wall Street or Tea Party or Arab Spring, around the world, trust has become more problematic.
Well, I think one of the reasons for that also is we put guidelines on trust. We put we put conditions on trust, and those conditions are causing us to get deluded within what we're doing and how we do it. And the moment that we start with somebody and they break, quote unquote, the tradition, look at politics. The great organization that was supposed to get us out of the financial debt recently, it had nothing to do with the good for you and I. It had to do with who was going to be right and who was going to be wrong, and a battle of ideology. They shouldn't have even started in the first place. You could have forecasted what was going to go on. So when you're dealing with trust, you got to be able to get in there, go to the table, values neutral, and instead of expanding on what you have, create something brand new.
So one of the variables I talk about in this decision stress model is similarities. When there's a lot of similarities in a bond among people, they're more likely to trust. So, for example, we were at a very high trust place after 9/11 as a country, because
yes.
our identity was we were all Americans. We've lost some of that, right? Now we have different identities, right? Whether it's Republicans or Democrats, it's been split. One of the reasons why we can't make progress is that we don't have a common philosophy of government. We don't, and without a common philosophy, without a set of values that we share, we can't cooperate and we can't trust. And that's true in companies. That's true in nations, right? Zappos, SAS, Quick Trip convenience stores, all three high trust organizations. Trust has been declining for 30 years. In business in general, it's been growing for 30 years in those organizations. Well, not Zappos, because it's a younger organization. But it's been growing during that same period. Why? Because they have common values and identities. They believe in the same things.
Now, by the way, how do you create that? When I say how do you create that, you have to come to the table with the people that you're going to deal with. And most people don't ask. You know, they take it for granted that this is how someone thinks, and that, Bob, is where the trouble starts. So what do you look for? What are the indicators that somebody's going to be in sync with your values?
Well, if you look at company, Zappos is a great example of this, what you're talking about. First of all, they themselves are very clear about what their values are as an organization. They spell it out very clearly in their value statement. They then look for those values in the employees that they hire. And actually, during training, they will actually offer you, the number has changed over the years, I think it's right now $2,000. They'll actually offer you $2,000 to quit.
Yeah.
And the idea there is, if you don't share the values that Zappos has, it's better for them if they know that now and you leave. And they'll actually pay you to leave. Right, so you have to recruit people that share some common values. You also, as an organization, have to clarify your values, and you may actually need to change your values over time. But world-class companies that have high trust, they do those things.
Yeah. No. And by the way, it makes sense, and wouldn't it be interesting? I've never experienced this before, but wouldn't it be very interesting if I were to apply for a job someplace, or if I was going to merge with another company, whatever the case may be? As we sat down, I would schedule my values and how I thought about certain things, have them do the same thing and see if we could match it up. If they ended up being matched up, all of a sudden you've got a place to go. If not, you have to sit back and negotiate. And is somebody going to, you know, do a little give and take? If it works, fine. If it doesn't, stop. And I think that what you've got here could be the difference between a company making it and a company not making it, especially in today's economy and the world in the way that it's going now.
You know, it's interesting you talk about mergers, and this is an interesting example of trust, right? Two companies come together. In order for them to cooperate with each other to achieve synergy and to raise the stock value, they have to establish trust. And how they go about that merger in some of these variables I talk about in the book is critical, right? Is there open communication? Is there integrity? Is there alignment of interests? Is there benevolent concern for the different parties, right? Do they leave something on the table, or do they try and be opportunistic and take everything for themselves? That's what I mean about sort of benevolence versus opportunism.
Sure.
You know, we know what trustworthiness is. We know what these variables are. You can actually merge two companies together in a way that actually enhances trust. One of my colleagues at Columbia worked with SmithKline-Beacham many years ago in their merger. They achieved synergy. If we were to look at Daimler-Chrysler, it was a disaster. They lost billions of dollars of market value because the two cultures never came together, there was never trust, and they never created synergy.
By the way, those things bring you to the last two things that you talk about, and it's the predictability and the communication. I talked about this before on the air, but it's the right time for this also. I can't tell you that, you know, I've done consulting for years, and I'd walk into a company and it would have the CFO, CEO, who was ever in charge, write down what their subordinate, their immediate subordinate was supposed to do, whatever managerial position there was. What is the job? What is that person's job? And then I would go to that person and I would say, write down what you think you're supposed to be doing. What is your job? You know what's coming. 9 out of 10 times, it never matched.
Right.
Yeah.
Lack of communication.
And if you don't have that, predictability goes right out the window.
No question about it. You know, one of the things that is most critical about trust is communication. If you don't have clear, transparent, open communication, you're not going to have trust. And I don't care whether it's a relationship between a husband and wife, two partners at a company, peers, etc. Communication is essential. And when trust breaks down, what you often see is also a breakdown in communication. So really, communication is the lifeblood of trust. Open, frequent, transparent communication where you align interests, you listen, you try and serve each other's interests, you're benevolent, you don't try and take everything yourself, you care about the other party, and you have integrity. You practice what you preach, which creates a certain predictability.
You know, you could look at this. I'm looking at the press release where it starts out with risk tolerance, adjustment, power, situational security, etc. It's almost like you would start risk tolerance at the bottom. If you've got that, you move into the adjustment. If you can adjust, you create the power, which creates the situational security. It's almost like level to level to level. It builds on itself.
I think that's right. You know, there's a complex mix that you can achieve to create trust. And if you understand that, you can navigate your way through that. One of the problems we have today is the world's a fast-changing, very complex place. And a lot of leaders haven't yet figured out how to manage in that kind of environment, in a complex multi-stakeholder situation. And so, you know, trust has been breaking down, and it's been breaking down for quite some time.
No question. We're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. DrBobHurley.com. That's DrBobHurley, HURLEY.com. And you'll find some more information on trust and some ideas on how to help build trust.
Wonderful. Hey, Bob, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was great being with you, Michael. Be well.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
You'll feel so lonely. You're going to miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. Well, I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only. 'Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in love, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away.
for you. Leave me. You know it's gonna be. You miss your brown eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Mary Camacho with us is the technology translator. She uses her background as an owner of two software development firms, her experience in finance and operation, and her master's degree in media and culture to help small businesses successfully navigate through the complexities of the internet in order to create affordable solutions for their online presence and web strategy. She's the author of The Internet Plan, a workbook for creating your online strategy. Mary, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's good to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. It is a strategy, isn't it? You can't just get on and do it, can you?
Well, you know, a lot of people do that, but you end up wasting a lot of time and a lot of money and having to go back and fix a lot of things when you do it that way.
I completely agree. And that's why I said it is a strategy. There are a lot of great people out there with great ideas and ideas that could be very successful, except nobody says this is the first step, then this is what you do next, and this is what happens if that's what happens. And I think that's where people fall down. And you're right. Unless you've got the strategy, unless you get a handle on it, I don't care how good it is, you're going to fall down.
That's right. And some of the things are pretty basic, but other things are a little bit more complex, and what happens is a lot of small business owners, new business owners especially, they get started, and they just don't even think that, oh, I need to consider technology first. And really, yeah, you need to think about technology before you have a business name. It starts that early.
No question about it. What got you involved in this in the first place? Where was it that you saw the opportunities that people were missing in doing what you do?
Well, my internet company, Joyatech, I've had for a long time, and before that I had another one, and we've always done websites, web applications, since the mid-90s. And so I've worked with a lot of business owners, a lot of small business owners, and what I found out is after years and years of doing this, I'd be talking to a lot of people who are very much non-techie, or they would be even afraid of technology. But they would come and they would say, I know I need a website, or I know I need a blog, or I know I need something, right? You can almost put anything in there. And after years of doing that, I got off the phone with a prospect one day and realized I had just been giving away hours and hours of consulting. And to be honest, it wasn't even making that big of a difference. It wasn't that effective. They weren't necessarily ready to hear it at the time. And at the moment, I decided I needed to write the Internet Plan as a workbook and not just put out a white paper or another thing that people can get a hold of, can get their hands on and understand. I wanted to write something that people could use, even if they're afraid of technology, to think about technology as a business owner. And that's what it does. And it kind of walks you through step by step. There's lots of little drawings and things like that that kind of have you think about the right aspects of your business, your name, your website, your blog, all the different parts and pieces, and create a broad strategy. And then take it on in a way that works. You can't do everything at once. So kind of step by step and then prioritize it.
Now, let me ask you this, and one of the things you bring up in your press release, and it's very true, people put too much emphasis on Google. And if you do that, you're going to run into an area whereby you're not seeing the expanded view, the vision. You get limited to how Google sees it and how Google does it, and you won't be able to see beyond that.
Well, yeah, you're right. What's happening is that the Internet has changed considerably since it first came into what I'd say real popular use in the mid-90s, late 90s really. In around 2007, Google changed some of their practices and with their search engines in particular, and I think this was the beginning of kind of the new trend, the new way that it is, the new reality of the Internet. And that's when they introduced personalization and personalized searching. And since then, everybody's getting on board with this. And what personalized search is that when you go and search for something on Google, the results that come back are based on a wide variety of factors that are related to you. I think I've heard comments, the algorithms are not available to the public, so there's no way I can go in unless I happen to have a source at Google and tell you exactly. But I've heard somebody say that 57 different personal attributes are used to determine what you see, distinct from what another person sees.
Yeah.
So that means they're looking at what kind of computer you have, what kind of operating system you're using, where you are, what things you've searched for. All of those things go into the mix, and so they start influencing what your results are. And so you start seeing a smaller and smaller sort of view of what's out there that's basically given to you by Google. Now, Google's not the only one doing it, though. This happens on Facebook, too. This happens on Netflix, you know, when you're looking at movies. It happens in a lot of places. More and more of the large internet companies are taking this practice into their algorithm for search.
Mm. Okay, well, all right, let's do it this way. I'm this average person that has a business, and I really want to use the internet. I have no idea what I'm doing. So I pick up the workbook. I go to the website, and I get the internet plan. What does it do for me? How does it help me? Take me by the hand, lead me through. I don't mean step by step through the entire workbook, but just get me started. Sure. What do we do?
Sure. Well, a lot of what it does is it kind of gives you a framework for thinking about what is important about technology before you even get started. You need to think about what are the foundations that I need as a business. I need you're talking about naming your business. Can your business name even be found on the internet? Is the domain even available? Is if the domain's available, if you look for it, will it ever show up? Or is it going to be, if somebody searches for it, are they instead going to find somebody who's been out in business for 20 years already? Sometimes naming your business with a strange name, like some of the companies we're familiar with, like Yahoo or Google or those, actually is a huge benefit. But a lot of people go for the traditional, and they'll name it, you know, Smith Consulting, right? Well,
sure.
It's very difficult
There's
to be thousands, found.
A million Smith Consultings out there.
Exactly. So it has people start at the very, very beginning. It has them consider, what is your business name? What are your product names? How are you going to be found on the internet just based on that first? And it's not all about search. The book is not all about search. That's not the only focus, but it has to be a consideration.
Here's an interesting point. I have been Michael Dresser all my life. About three, 4 years ago, we took a look at the internet and we realized there's six or seven Michael Dressers out there. So, you know, there's one from Baltimore. You know, he's a great journalist. I talked to him. There's a doctor. There's a skateboarder and so on and so forth. And I thought the name was different. I guess it wasn't different. So I started using my middle name, Michael Ray. And I don't know why, but overnight I became Michael Ray. People I've known for years, it's all of a sudden it's Michael Ray. And I keep telling them they're saying it wrong. It's Mako Rai, but they don't want to go for that. But anyhow, it was that just a little bit of branding, a little bit of difference made all the difference in the world.
Right. And so that's the starting point. And then it goes on to look at beyond that, what do you really need? You need email. You need website. You may or may not need to use social media. You may or may not need something like a blog. It really has people go through, and there's fun little quizzes in the book. For example, there's the social media compatibility quiz. And basically it's looking at not only it asks you questions whether or not you need them, whether or not they're going to make a difference for your business. Because if you get if you get all of your customers through a referral, what do you need some of this for? Nobody's looking for you online.
But the point, I think the point is that presence online. If you get all your customers from referral, that's wonderful. But what about all those customers that you could have had?
That's true. But for a lot of small businesses, and I work a lot with consultants, and I've had consultants come to me that are actually too busy, and they're looking for a website, and they do need one, right? They need a professional presence on the internet. Don't get me wrong. But they may not need one that has everybody in the world find them. They may not need to spend the money on search engine optimization. They may not need to spend the time on some of the social media, foundations or programs like Facebook or LinkedIn because they already have a business that is fully, that mean they can't take any more business. I've had people do that. And yet,
sure.
There's a lot to, when you invest your time in something like a Facebook page, if you want it to be professional, it takes something.
No, it makes sense. But you know what? Most people, and Mary, they don't know what the word professional means. And I think that's really a key. If we want to be professional. We want to be branded. We want to be different out there. We want people to come to us instead of the guy next door, quote unquote. But it's called, how do you be professional? That's like people. That's why people like yourself do what you do. You say, Michael, this is how you become professional. And I say, oh, okay, I can do that. And then you move.
And when you're looking at it, some of those points, there's no book that can tell you that the 10 things that you can do that will guarantee that you'll be perfect and you'll be found and you'll be professional and all those ways. There's tips, and there's lots of those throughout the book. You know, make sure you have your email on your own domain. If you have a website, marycamacho.com, well, I have that one, but that's not my email because I use my company. But if you have your own domain for your company, your email should be on that domain. But I can't tell you how many people I've worked with who have Yahoo and Google email when they're sitting there with a fantastic domain name and website.
Yeah, no, I got it loud and clear. As a matter of fact, would you say most people fall into the trap of, I'm going to say this very crudely, they don't know what they're doing. They think they know, but they don't. And it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know you don't know that keeps you back, keeps you stagnant, and keeps you in trouble. And I really believe, and with all the people I've talked to over the years, most people think they know, they don't know.
Right. Well, and what's interesting is a lot of people think that they know and they don't, as you're saying. And a lot of those folks are trying to do it themselves. And there's huge resources out on the internet about how to do this or how to do that. There's all the websites that you can put together on your own. There's all those different sorts of things. What I'm trying to answer is a series of different questions. Instead of how to, it's why. What do you need to do and why do you need to do it? And sometimes it's why don't you need to do it?
Which makes sense. Which makes all the sense in the world. Mary, I hate to do this. We're starting to run out of time. Again, the website we can find you at.
It's theinternetplan.com.
Okay, internetplan.com. Can we find the book there?
It's theinternetplan.com. T-H-E at the very
the
beginning.
Okay. Yeah, and if anybody missed it, it'll be up on our website.
That's right. Thanks so much for having me on your show tonight. I appreciate it.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Good night.
Good night.
I wrap the towel around me and I open the door and then splish splash, I jump back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing, reeling with the feeling, moving and a grooving, rocking and a rolling. Bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug. Split the block, they were doing the bop. All the tunes had the dancing bug. There was Lollipop with a Peggy Sue. Good and golly, Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on. I was a splishing and a splashing. I was a rolling and a strolling. Yeah, I was a man.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. We're going to really do some thought provoking. Matt Cotugno's here. He's come back again. He was born in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, educated at Pennsylvania State University, received his master's of fine arts degree in playwriting from Florida State University, and he was a teaching assistant. That's where he was. His stage work has been produced in New York, Los Angeles, and in regional theaters. His prose has been published in various venues. He has contributed to 6 volumes in The Good Company, published by Livewire Press in Virginia, and was a featured writer in its most recent edition. And he is the author of the book In Dracula's Time. Matt, I welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Michael. It's nice to be back.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. In Dracula's Time. You know, when we really come down to it, let me tell you what I picture when you say that. I have this image. Not the original, but I think one of the first talkies in the movies was Bela Lugosi. And he had, what was his name? He had, there was a real estate guy that was dealing with him in Transylvania. And they came over on the ship, and everybody in the ship was dead. And they walked into the hole, and the guy looked up, and they said, "How did you exist?" And he said, "Rats. I ate rats. I will always remember that." But there
Bram Stoker's original Dracula starts with a real estate person visiting Transylvania and meeting Count Dracula. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it was.
Yeah. What I have done is kind of. Start with that. As you know, Michael, you know, Dracula is so popular in modern pop culture. He's an icon.
Sure.
Everyone. And there's been so many spinoffs, the whole vampire genre, horror, and all of that. In Dracula's Time actually begins and focuses on the person who lived in the Middle Ages, Vlad Dracul, who was Bram Stoker's inspiration, many people feel, for the fictional Dracula. My character is the real person.
Oh, no, by the way, I just remembered his name. It was Renfield.
Renfield, okay.
That was the
real thing. Yeah, that's right. Renfield. I think that person appears in Bram Stoker's novel also, Dracula, I think In Dracula's Time, my work, I think is both a continuation of the Dracula saga. It's a clarification of its real history, and it's also a new take on the Dracula legend. Vlad Dracul, he lived in Wallachia, which is present-day Romania, in the 15th century, the 1400s, and his battle was a clash of civilizations between Christian and Muslim worlds. The Ottoman Turks were coming from the south and invading Wallachia, and he used terror as a weapon to fight the invasion of his homeland by the Muslims. And I think even as I talk, you can understand how we're still fighting that battle today, in a manner of speaking.
Sure. No question. The battle has never been over with. But I think realistically, the real story of Dracula, you know, Vlad the Impaler, he killed a lot of people. Now, obviously, it turned into vampires, but the original guy, the one who started all of this, the one that the story is about, not that I would like to be like him, but it was fascinating. It was something that people really should know about.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He was all the stories that you sounds like you know a little bit about the real history, and many people do, about Vlad Dracul. My book, In Dracula's Time, is, I dare say, very well documented, very well. I'm a student of history, and I really went to the pain of making it very historically accurate, telling the real story, because finally, I think truth is both stranger and as dramatic as fiction.
No question about it.
And I think it certainly is here.
Now, Vlad himself, what kind of a man was this?
Well, he was of noble lineage, noble birth. His father and his grandfather were princes, were lords of this what is modern day Romania, called Wallachia then. So there was a whole line of power. He was an ally of Hungary, which was a very, very powerful country then, and he was one of the successors to the Greek Romans, who could not keep up with the Turks in Constantinople, which is now, of course, Istanbul, fell in 1453. My story, In Dracula's Time, takes place around 20 years after that, in the aftermath of that. And it's about, really, the backdrop is the end of the Roman Empire. It's kind of hard to picture what that meant to people, Christians, let's say, living in the Balkan Peninsula, when all of a sudden Rome didn't exist anymore, even in the form of the Greek Romans, who were the successors to the Romans from Italy. So it was traumatic times, and there was upheaval was the norm.
Matt, let me ask you this, because I'm listening. Let me ask you this. I'm listening very closely to you, and I didn't realize that he led the charge, you know, with the Christians against the Muslims in that era. What? And here's the question. I don't know, but I'm starting to look at it a little differently now. Was the guy a hero or was he a bad guy?
Well, that's a good question. That's the essential question, and that's something that my book, In Dracula's Time, struggles with. I think, you know, it comes up in the book. There's a line, how do you fight fire? And a character says, I don't know, with water? And the other person says, no, actually, with greater fire. You fight fire with fire. And that is where his, is he a hero or is he a villain? The answer is in that. If you recognize that to stop an invasion, to stop very fierce people who are bent on conquering you, what lengths do you go to? And
there's an old adage also, you fight fire with fire, but you also don't take a knife to a gunfight.
That's right. Well, that's right. Yes. You have to match what you're dealing with. Yeah. And he actually, you know, as you probably know, he wound up losing that battle, at least temporarily, Vlad Dracul. You know, Wallachia was a small country. The Ottoman Empire was quite large and quite powerful then, and would be powerful for another 100 years in the Balkan Peninsula and further on. The Muslims were not stopped until the gates of Vienna, some 50 years after Vlad Dracul's time. So he fought a losing battle, but, you know, was he noble? I don't know. He was cruel. All the stories you've heard are probably true, but he did what he had to do, and he had the blessing of other Christians, you know, who tried to be his ally and stop the tide.
Now, by the way, time and place. I mean, you know, obviously, we look at what he would have done today; it doesn't quite work. But in those days, condone right. it, don't condone it. Yes. That's not the point here. The point, and from what I'm really hearing, is that the man for his people was a hero. He fought the enemy.
Yes.
He fought the enemy at their level, and he did what he had to do. I guess the real question
That's
is,
right.
Matt, how did they turn him into the bloodsucker, the always living life and attacking people?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book also. I mean, I think it might sound a little silly for me to say he got a bad deal with history, but in a manner of speaking, I think he did. I think what Bram Stoker did was he was concerned with a horror story. It was entertainment for him, and it wasn't history. And if I can just take one step back, my book In Dracula's Time actually begins in the present and is bracketed at the end in the present also. And it's based on a true incident that happened to me as the writer, and that is years ago at Penn State when I was going to school there. I met an old man who told me that he knew Bram Stoker. And I was skeptical, but when you look at the math of it, this was in 1970. This man was an old man. Bram Stoker died in 1912. He could indeed have known him in Ireland. This fellow was from Dublin. And he told me that Bram Stoker actually regretted that he didn't concentrate more on the history in bringing Dracula to life. I thought that was fascinating. Whether this fellow is that's true or not, that inspired me. And so my novel begins with me as a young man meeting this old man who then tells me the story. And
yeah.
The book goes into the historical fiction part of it. And at the end of it, it's bracketed back in the present time with me wondering, gee, is this guy telling the truth or not? Maybe I'll write about it and see what people think. So that's kind of the structure of the...
And thank God, I knock on wood that I never had to go into combat. I mean, I would have gone if I had gone, but I was too young for Korea. By the time Nam came around, I was in and out already. But the point of contention is that you do what you have to do to protect the people that you love. And when you got
yes.
a guy like that, and again, I'm listening to what you're saying, I'm getting an entirely different look at it. You had to, quote unquote, you had to fight fire with fire, but you had to fight fire with more fire. That is military.
Yes.
It's military thinking, and that's the thinking in the way that you would win it. And why would you go in trying to lose? You go in time and
right.
place, you do what you have to do, and that's what gets done.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, moral dilemmas are always dramatic, of course, because as we're speaking, it even reminds me of the whole issue of torture. You know, what is torture and how much do you do to get what you need? You know, do you try to save 100 people by torturing one person? I don't have the answer to these questions. That's where moral dilemma comes in, but I think it's pretty
sure.
dramatic.
Yeah, but when you deal with morality, and I don't want to shift away from our topic here, but when you're dealing with a morality, you have to deal with the definition of morality based on who it is. I.e., give you a prime example. you have this friend who says to you, it's a young girl, she's 14 years old, she said, I'm going to commit suicide, don't tell anybody. So you want to be loyal to that person, and you want to be moral, you want to show ethics with her. But then again, she's going to kill herself. So if you go tell her mother that she's going to kill herself so her mother stops her, are you being non-ethical? Are you breaking bonds? Are you breaking promises? Where's the morality?
Yeah.
So it depends on whose eyes you're looking through.
Yeah, the in Dracula's Time actually features a young man who is enlisted by Vlad Dracul to write his secret biography before it's too late, because the Turks are coming is the notion. And this young man actually goes through the moral dilemma that we're talking about. He's taking dictation. Vlad Dracul is talking about his life, talking about the lengths he went to fight for his people, the torture that he put people through. And the young man, Kasha Pru, his name is in the book, is torn. You know, dude, this is his instinct as a young person. Of course, when you're young, you're always a little more liberal, and you feel like, wow, this is terrible. But he also knows that his country is being invaded. And so I think that really kind of plugs in to the whole moral dilemma that we all face in our own individual lives, but that Vlad Dracul faced. And if people get anything out of my book, I think it's discussion. It's to say, well, gee, maybe there are shades of gray when it comes to, like you were talking about, war. And
sure,
I think there certainly are. So,
yeah, but it's where did the vampires come from? And when I say that, it's an entirely different world. They took what he did, which was bloody. There's no question about it. But they created something was created out of that had nothing to do with the original story. A lot of bloodletting.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. Yeah, but it wasn't sucking somebody's blood out because here's the difference. I think I just got the difference. The difference was he was killing to protect. What the main emphasis, what the vampires are, is they are drinking blood to survive, to live. Well, maybe there's a close proximity.
Yeah, actually, as you say that does sound similar. I think, as far as I understand it, the vampire legend, you know, that part of the world, Romania, Eastern Europe, was really at the time kind of draped in this Gothic secrecy and secret societies and superstition, and those kind of notions, I think, sort of fed into religious extremism even, and of course the violent times that people lived in then, I think, sort of all kind of swirled together and created this notion of vampires. But they certainly were rooted, I think, in this violent, violent times that Vlad Dracul struggled in. And Bram Stoker came along, of course, a couple of 300-400 years later, and doing his research, he read about all of these superstitions, but also read about the real people in history who fought.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know this, but in the novel Dracula, Bram Stoker's original novel, he actually mentions Vlad Dracul, not by name, but in the first chapter, he talks about his ancestor who lived years ago and fought the Turks who were invading the land. So a lot of people don't catch that. Dracula, but
somewhere we're missing something. And they said, you know what, 4 o'clock in the morning is going to hit me. I'll call you. I'll let you know.
Okay.
There's a bridge to this somewhere. Anyways, Matt, we're just about out of time. Website, we can find you.
Okay. Okay, yeah, thanks so much for having me, Michael. You know, if folks go on Amazon.com, they look for In Dracula's Time, or they search for Matt Cutugno, that's Cutugno. You'll see my two books, the other one we spoke about a few months ago, but In Dracula's Time is what I'd like them to take a look at. And it's actually on sale now. It's quite affordable, so please check it out.
Wonderful. Hey, Matt, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Michael. Always a pleasure. You do a great job.
Take care. Good night.
Good night to you.
Comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. they say in this case, that's all there is. There isn't.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
A moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends.